Black Cats Run podcast. I'm Tristan Black Ingersoll, and this is Black Cats Run. On today's episode, first episode in quite a while, I want to share an update about our forthcoming book, The Blood and the Rain. A lot of people have been waiting patiently, so I have some information to share with you about that status, and also want to talk about a topic of, I think, fundamental significance to training in all endurance sports and probably sports in general: volume. How do you get volume to work for you, and does volume actually work? Let's get into today's episode. So before we get into the main focus of today's episode, I wanted to provide an update on the status of the forthcoming book, our forthcoming book, The Blood and the Rain. So the big thing for me is this year, my wife and I had our first kid, and as a consequence, as I'm sure many of you know from your own experience, that can kind of have a pretty big sea change on how you organize your time. And so the book as a manuscript is complete, but the process of going through and rereading and revising is what we've been working on over the summer. And originally we were on track to release that in July, but due to unforeseen circumstances and changes in routine, I haven't had the blocks of time where I can really sit down and get into that process of reading through the manuscript, making sure everything is the way that we want it to be. So the book is still forthcoming, hopefully sooner rather than later. I would generalize and say this fall, and if it takes longer than that, I will release another chapter preview on the podcast for people who are looking to get a little bit more of that prior to the book's release. The other thing I want to address is update on the status of the podcast itself and where we're at with the pod. The process with the podcast has been sort of set to the side, put on the back burner as I increased the rate of work on the book. But as the book process winds down, the podcast is going to be able to start spinning up again. So a lot of people have been, you know, reaching out, asking for updates on the podcast, in addition to asking for updates on the book. So those things are still in the works. And basically because there's certain minimum quality standards that I've set for myself in terms of what I think is worth recording for the podcast and what I think would be worth, you know, putting out in publication, you know, even if we're not necessarily tapping into a huge audience, that's still something that I think is part of the process for me. And part of the aspiration is, you know, can I do something of substance, something that's maybe a little bit beyond, maybe a little bit in a different direction, but go in a different direction, but do that in a way with integrity, because it's really easy to generate a lot of stuff and just basically be regurgitatory, copycatting the stuff that, you know, seems to be getting consumed. And, you know, even when those things in and of themselves are not actually meaningful, and then it's also easy to just diverge in a way that is divergence for the sake of divergence, right? Let me just go in a different or a weird direction. And we don't really want to be doing that either, at least not within the bounds of Black Cats Run. So that's where we are with that. And I appreciate all the people, reaching out and continuing to express interest in, the stuff that we have to offer. Definitely helps me be motivated to, push through some of these immediate limiters in terms of that process and try to get back into the rhythm that we've been at in the past. So the title of this episode is The Fulcrum Effect. And let's start with that as our foundational concept. So fulcrum, right, refers to a lot of times you see this as like an illustrated diagram where there's like something that looks like a triangle, and then there's sort of a line, representing a plank or a board. And then on one side of that, right, teeter-totter point, that tipping point where the board rests on the triangle, to one side, there's a down force, and the other side, there's a mass that the board is wet or the line is underneath. And as many people know, right, the concept of a fulcrum is that by positioning that triangle, that fulcrum, relative to the mass you're trying to move, you can essentially have more effectiveness with regards to the force that you apply. And you can make this easier or harder, right? Now, if you could simply go directly to the object in question and just pick the mass up and move it, you would not really need to bother setting up a fulcrum, right? So the point of a fulcrum is you're creating mechanical advantage. And what you're trying to do to problem solve in that issue is, okay, I'm trying to elevate something, right, to move something from a current state to a different state. And it's recognizing, okay, the best way to do this is to do it in the most sort of efficient and easy way possible. But I would suggest that in sports training, fitness, exercise, and a lot of other areas too, and in life that involve practice towards improvement over time, people think about it the exact opposite. They basically try to either situate their effective fulcrum as far away from the mass in question as possible, or they eschew the concept of trying to find some sort of leverage at all. And there's this idea of going right at it. And that is couched in a lot of, moral concept. And I think that there's a strong component of cultural delusion because we have a really hard time in American culture, certainly, separating in a lot of different areas the myth-making apparatus from reality. And there's this oversubscription to these things that have been presented to us, and we've learned through the process of repetitive archetyping. And it becomes a highly scripted process where it's very easy for people to simply pick up and, in a sense, the metaphorical sense, read through that script and follow those motions, right? So things like, you need, train hard, no pain, no gain. And but this is not just a few, anecdotes or, supposed truisms that people cast around in social contexts or in Strava captions and Instagram posts. What I think is, I think this is more fundamentally embedded, this concept of sort of like disquestioning, right? I'm not going to say unquestioning, because unquestioning would mean that we don't ask the right questions. Disquestioning, which I'm sort of coining here to try to make a distinction of meaning, disquestioning would refer to the way in which people do ask questions, but they ask questions that are consistent with and reinforcing the narrative. So if people see X, Y, and Z on the application end, right, or on the input side of a process or a social experience, then they take that to mean this other outcome should be happening. But there's this inversion of thought where when the outcome doesn't occur instead of saying, which should be obvious, okay, these inputs do not actually then lead to that outcome. That is mistaken. Instead, people say, well, that's wrong and that shouldn't be like that, that somehow the outcome is wrong. And this just is, you know, in basic defiance of all logic, reason, and the fundamental principles of causality across all disciplines of study, all fields and areas of academic and practical application. You know, causality is that when you do something, the resulting effect is most likely tied to the input. Now, not always, right? It could be that we don't understand the input. It could be something within the input. It could be another variable besides the input that was unrecognized. But it is certainly the case, you know, that, you know, if you have a, you know, input and then the expected effect does not occur, right, then that is going to strongly suggest that that input was confused. And I think that because this is an ingrained social behavior, right, and I think a simple exemplar of this would be social relationships, right, of all kinds, right, familial, professional, interpersonal, et cetera, would be a space in which we see this kind of problematic and embedded thought process, right, where we codify and then interpret certain behaviors as indicative of blank, right? Which is that, okay, if somebody, you know, asks me how my day is, then that must mean they're, you know, that they're willing to talk to me, you know, I've been professional, right? I get this person, you know, is respectful of me or whatever, right? But it might be the case that somebody doesn't really think highly of you, and instead maybe they're, you know, saying, oh, well, there's a function to this, which is if I apply this behavior, I will get the social reward of generating this perception from the other person. And I think that pattern of thought is that we tend to be disquestioning, right? And well, that must mean that, right? And instead of just being like, oh, okay, my concept of cause and effect needs to be revised, we start fighting in this disquestioning way to try to maintain that narrative. And then when we recognize, and I think this is the significant conceptual bridge, when we recognize that this effect has transference from this domain of, you know, social behavior, cultural behavior, and then we start to look and ask questions about, well, how are we behaving in the context of, you know, fitness and training, right? Which, you know, in a sense, is itself, right, going to be a cultural, social kind of behavior for sure. But we start to recognize, like, okay, right, if, like, and this is a general conceit of the podcast, that because people are people, right, and we exist within these spaces of culture and thinking and ideology and what, and, you know, other variables along those lines, if we recognize that, then we must logically, you know, apply the framework that when we think about training and the way people approach and engage in it, that that is going to be filtered through that same, you know, plane of conceptualization, the conceptual way of framing and thinking about and engaging with the world. And so in training terms, right, if we say, okay, run 5 times a mile, do 2 times 20 minutes, ski 20 hours a week, swim 10,000 yards, right? Whatever these, pick something, right? You know, something that's challenging and hard and difficult to do. And then we say, okay, and our belief is, well, that means, right, that I'm going to get this outcome, that I'm going to get better. That's what that means, right? Now, we have been told to expect, have that expectation, okay? So in the same way that, you know, simple social example, let's use that same simple social example. Somebody says, hey, how are you doing today, right? You know, some people might say, oh, okay, you know, this person, they want to chat and, you know, see what's going on and they're interested in what I'm up to, right? Well, they might not be, right? And I think that's an easy one to get to use, because I think a lot of us can start to pretty quickly recognize, well, no, you know, actually, usually you just kind of say that because you're supposed to say that. right? And it could be genuine, but oftentimes it's, you know, this thing to fill the space, right? To fill the social space. But our dispositional bias can affect that. You know, if we want to feel that people in general or a particular individual is taking notice, right, of us, maybe what we're doing, a contribution we've made in a, you know, professional environment, things of that nature, we're going to be inclined to want to see things actually meaning and indicating something that we want them to see. And we apply that same psychology to the way we think about our training, right? So if we have, you know, been told that, okay, if you go out and you get, you know, do this stuff and you have to train hard, right? And generally speaking, everybody knows training hard means being, you know, exhausted and being trashed and, you know, spending hours every month Googling recovery hacks to try to figure out what to do about your fatigue. But there's this general belief that, okay, you know, that's a really good thing. I'm dysfunctional. I'm struggling to do training. You know, everything feels, you know, monumental, you know, and leveling, right, down to our essence. And we think, okay, that's great. That's working. And then the reality is, in point of fact, people really aren't improving doing that, you know. And I think it's most evident with people who've been working at these kinds of sports for a little while, because there's that initial effect where, you know, at first you could, you know, do bicep curls and probably improve your running or your cycling a little bit if you're starting from the point of being a couch potato. But once you've sort of established the benefits of being a generally physically active person, that's when you really start to determine whether or not training any particular way is actually effective or not. But we want to see it working, right? So what this has created, in a sense, and the framing that I'm trying to describe using these social parallels and cultural parallels, is it's created a general norm culture within fitness training, especially endurance sports, but I'm sure other fitness domains as well, that working hard is what creates success. So if you work hard and are miserable and are trashing yourself, and then you don't get the outcomes or the improvements that you want, people actually aren't generally reaching the conclusion that, okay, training hard is dysfunctional. Now, some people do recognize this, but writ large, you know, the sort of the zeitgeist of this fitness, endurance fitness space doesn't make that shift. Instead, it's like, well, that outcome is wrong, right? And that is, again, that inversion of causality. And I think when we see that that is not something that only happens in that space, but this acceptance of like, well, these are these stories and they mean these things, right? But we're picking up and reading from the script when we think that. You know, my great example for me would be the first workout I did as a college athlete, in a sense, was over the summer, and Coach Fresh had sent out some document with some sessions, right? So I go down to the local track, and that was something like a few times a mile and a half, maybe two times or three times a mile and a half. And he had some weird calculation thing, and I arrived at the conclusion that, okay, I'm supposed to run this at like 6:20 pace. So I did it. It was summer, right? So, you know, weather was making things challenging. I was uncomfortable, but it, you know, was manageable. And I felt, okay, this first thing I've been asked to do, college coach, I execute it. This is great. Send him an email. He emails me back. Oh no, that should have been at 5:30 pace. Well, that's impossible, right? You know, I was sort of borderline running at 6:20 pace doing that session in June. No way I was going to bring that down. Could have brought that down any faster. And that time, I just said, okay, well, I can't do these. This whole schedule is pointless, you know. So I just threw it out the window and just kind of did what I felt was appropriate for the rest of the summer. You know, but that might have been a product of as much my sort of like dismay as that as it was any sort of belief, because more broadly, you know, the process of exercise and training for me from middle school, so you know, basically from the age of 10, really, up through my mid to late 20s, at least, was just unquestioning. And, you know, doing training with varying levels of, you know, commitment, but training nonetheless across all that time span. And every time I was like, okay, I want to get it going. I want to, you know, raise my fitness. It was just start following the schedule and be unquestioning. And training is supposed to be hard. And, you know, that is what actually is going to cause the effect. And yet, that I want. And the effect that I wanted, the outcome was never occurring. And despite that fact, I just kept going back to that and going back to that and going back to that. And you then assume, right, you start to develop this compensatory logic, right? You know, I'm not good enough. So let's use another parallel example to think about how this could play out in another context, right? Let's say that you have a supervisor or a manager or an employer, right? And you're given an assignment or you have a task or role and you do that. And then the manager or supervisor tells you that what you did wasn't good, it wasn't acceptable, right? That it was subpar, right? It's very difficult unless you have a lot of experience and a lot of confidence and surety. It's very difficult to look at that and be like, well, they don't know what they're talking about. I think over time, you know, interestingly enough, people do, right? And I use the workplace here as an example because that's something for a lot of people where we actually have the most consistent, unavoidable exposure. With interpersonal stuff, we can just sort of be like, you know what? I shut down. I'm disengaging from it. This is overwhelming. This is too draining. This is too demanding. But in the workplace, you don't have as much choice, right? You have to be engaged in that space in order to get the benefits of income, et cetera. So eventually, actually, you do see people start to arrive at that. But, you know, nonetheless, right, you're in a position where a lot of times, right, you might be left questioning yourself. Or even if you know, well, I know what I did was right, then the question you might still be was, well, why isn't this person accepting me, right? And the sense, and it ultimately comes down to what could I have done differently? Did I need to do this? Did I need to do that? Did I not send enough emails? Did I send too many emails? Right? Do I, you know, need to make somebody cookies on their birthday? Like, whatever the case may be, all kinds of possibilities. Right? And the reality is, a lot of times, the problem might not actually be you. The problem might just be that the other person isn't competent, isn't engaging with that in that way. And in that same parallel sense, right, when we're applying a training strategy and the training strategy doesn't work, why is it this automatically the cycle of self-blame? And what, you know, I'm trying to describe is that, and what I think we should be recognizing at this point very clearly is that that cycle of reasoning basically just siphons us back in to that same vicious cycle of assuming and attempting to apply these patterns of causality to create a fitness outcome that just quite frankly aren't likely to ever occur. You know, if you work on something for years and you get injured, right? And this could be a lot of things. Getting injured, I think, would be a common experience, right? Getting burnt out happens, you know, not maybe as common. A lot of people maybe will push themselves hard enough that they'll get injured before that, right? Or just general kind of exhaustion and dysfunction, right? Maybe not to the point of burnout, maybe not getting injured, but just like things feeling inconsistent, not being able to execute things that you would think would be reasonable targets, not being able to sort of like live up to your aspirations, right? Just sort of a sense of stagnation. And what do you do with that? Well, you need an alternative framework to think about this. And what could that alternative be? Well, I think that we should think about training not as a dosing of adversity where the, you know, dosing size equals the potency, But we want to think of training as a process by which we're trying to metaphorically generate mechanical advantage and use that mechanical advantage to allow us to move forward. Because the act of simply trying to brute force our fitness, again, only works in that sort of neophyte phase of transitioning from being an inactive to an active person. You have these sort of holistic, you know, benefits that just sort of occur, and then you hit the ceiling on that, and that's like a hard stop. And, you know, the question would become, well, what do we do from there, right? What happens after that point? And, you know, the reality is there is no easy, obvious answer presented to us. And one way we know that's true is because if there was, then we wouldn't see people trapped in this sort of vicious loop, you know. And, you know, we don't really recognize the people, you know, who quit and sort of move on in a sense. You know, the reality is they're doing that because it's like, okay, this sucks, right? I don't want to do this anymore. This isn't rewarding. This isn't what I expected, you know. And I think a lot of times the conclusion is maybe this isn't for me. I can't do this. But, you know, especially if you think about simple things like running, like everybody should be able to run. Maybe not everybody's going to run 4:30 pace for 2 hours, but like everybody should be able to run. It's a basic physical capacity. So if we can't do it, then, and this is the idea, right, is that we should be saying, okay, well, clearly what I'm doing doesn't work because I should be able to do this, right? This outcome is fundamentally attainable, right? That should be, should therefore, if I'm not getting that outcome, I have to discard whatever my input is. But we have become so defensive of the input that we don't know how to engage with this differently. And, you know, I think in general it's confusing and also fascinating because training is just littered with paradoxes where if you start, you know, looking for them, it's like looking for sand dollars at the beach, right? Once you start looking and you find one, it's like all of a sudden they're everywhere, right? But you have to have it really in your mind's eye and you have to give it that high level of attention. Otherwise, everything just kind of blends back into the background. And one core problem here is the volume paradox. And this is one of the ways in which this sort of brute force versus this alternative, right, the fulcrum effect of, you know, seeking a way to think about training as how can I gain mechanical advantage, right, to sort of multiply what I apply to move my benchmarks, right? How does that work? So, and I think the volume conversation is oftentimes presented as a debate. And the camps on this are, you know, staked out as basically high volume versus low volume concepts, you know, and concepts within that, you know, are people using overtraining, supercompensation, junk mileage, right? There's sort of this rhetoric of conversation, these things that people use as sort of these bludgeons to pull out and sort of say, somebody says, well, I think you need to train a lot. Then somebody else says, that's junk miles or junk volume. And it's basically I'm not engaging in the conversation, right? You're overtraining, right? Things of that nature. And this isn't the right way to understand it is the problem, right? Is that we've accepted, once again, right? We've accepted an archetype of perception, right? Oh, this is how things are. This is the way things should be. I need to follow that script, right? And the thing is, you know, because we're in paradigm, right, we don't see that it's a script because it's the paradigm that we inhabit, right? To get out of that, you need a paradigm shift. You need to be able, and which, you know, the engenderification of a paradigm shift, of course, is that when the current answers provided by a paradigm are no longer sufficient to the questions being asked. Right. So moving away from that script is very challenging because it's paradigm based and paradigms fundamentally resist change. Right. Too, you know, which given this context, you know, make it totally aligns with what we're framing here. The right way to think about volume and training then is to ask yourself, right, what is the purpose? Is volume the big, heavy mass object that you're trying to pick up and move. Because most people think that they're trying to improve their fitness, but what they're actually trying to do is just tackle the bear of their training process, right? And they're in this, you know, death match with a polar bear, you know, or some, you know, primordial beast, you know, from the abyss that you just aren't going to win, you know, and that's what it looks like for the vast majority of people. And, you know, people subscribe to exceptionalism as another way to defend all of this. And the exceptionalist argument, you know, basically goes that, well, you know, only a small percentile of people can actually be high achieving. And the only way you can find out if you're one of them is, you know, to get into the cage, you know, and let the gate swing closed behind you. But, you know, and so again, right, instead of asking the question, people say, well, why isn't this working, right? This should be working. Why isn't it working? And ultimately, the conclusion is, again, what? It's, well, there must be something wrong with me. Why am I not good enough? Why am I not acceptable, right? What is my failing as an athlete? Am I not tough enough? Am I not motivated enough? Do I not know how to handle the pain, et cetera, et cetera? And that becomes like a really negative downward spiral over time for a lot of people. But if we think of volume, right, the amount of training we're doing, right, our aggregation of activity, we should think of that as basically the fulcrum, right, that we're using that to leverage this object of mass, which is really like, where is our fitness level? What's our current capacity? And we are applying, right, we say, okay, how can I move that? Because the reality is, like, ceteris paribus, like, people's fitness doesn't improve over the course of their life, really. You know, you get a little older, or you become an adult, and then you gradually are going to decline, right? So as things are, right, things really aren't going to improve. If you want to get stronger and improve the quality of your life and, you know, become competent at endurance sports, then, you know, you need to be able to apply something to that, right? So that's the thing that you're moving, is you're moving this thing of entity, right, of self, this sort of entity mass. And where do you situate that fulcrum, and what does the volume look like in terms of that metaphor? Well, creating the volume and applying the volume is about finding not this idea of doing low volume or high volume, because what does that mean? Right? If we think about it, the idea is, well, there's an optimal point to put the fulcrum to get the most mechanical advantage. And the question is just situating that, right? And when we recognize that, it's saying, oh, okay, this isn't a pick high volume, pick low volume. This idea of high or low volume is just a total red herring. The real question is, are you at a tipping point, right, where you can start to get that effect? Right, where you can start to leverage your fitness. And if your fitness is improving, then that's how you know the training you're doing is effective. And you can look at that and say, okay, I'm doing this particular amount. But at, you know, any given time in the course of long-term, you know, commitment with sports and these kinds of endeavors, you know, that volume isn't always going to be experienced the same. You know, some people say, well, I do my best running off of 60 miles a week. I can't do 110 miles a week. Well, you probably could run 110 miles a week. You just can't, you're not approaching it the right way, right? And so, and you know, the reality is, functionally, it is the case that we would tend to think over time that people are going to, like, get better outcomes by progressing from lower volume to higher volume. But one of the primary drivers of that, especially in sports that measure volume in terms of travel distance, you know, like running, counting your miles per week, is if you get fitter, you're getting faster, right? So if you run at 12-minute pace versus running at 6-minute pace, that's a world of difference in the amount of miles that you're going to do. But are you actually doing more volume per se in practice? And that, then you get into this question about, well, you know, kilojoules versus metabolic work, blah, blah, blah. But that then feeds us back into that concept of, well, high volume, low volume, I don't know, what am I doing, right? But that's this idea of, well, if I do low volume, I'll improve. Or if I do high volume, I'll improve. Oh, I didn't improve. Why didn't the low volume work? Oh, I didn't improve. Why didn't the high volume work? But it's not going to work because the input structure doesn't function, right? Because that input structure is this idea that what you're doing is you're just the entity mass you're engaged with is the training. But that's the wrong way to think about it. The training is the thing you're using to leverage the fitness and to try to move the fitness up. And in a sense, right, more volume basically will tend to move the fulcrum closer to the point at which mechanical advantage is greater, right? But you also, and this may be stretching the metaphor a little bit, I'm not sure, but you also need to be able to be at a point where you can, like, you know, where the board, right, is strong enough, right, to, you know, like, not break over the fulcrum point, right? And so you need to have some capacity, right, to engage that leverage point too, right? And a part of that is, like, you know, training to train, right? Training is leveraging our fitness level, and then that increased fitness level changes the kind of training that we can then proceed to apply. So obviously, we can then divide things into the people for whom it is working and for whom it isn't, right? You know, and simple question would be, start with, well, how fast are you? And, well, if you're, quotes, quotes, too slow, then volume just won't work, right? And the reason for that isn't because of being too slow as a personal judgment, but it's like, you know, there's a, to run, you can only go so slow, after which point you are walking. And I think walking's great if you like walking, but the problem is, from an adaptive standpoint and from a, like, what am I doing standpoint, the problem is that you see this, I guess, outcome where, you know, if you're getting totally winded and you feel totally sucker punched running 11:30 pace, right, then your ability to go easy and be comfortable, which is what needs to be happening most of the time in training, especially if you want to do training of much volume at all, is totally compromised. You can't do that because anything you do is demanding. And that's where the hardest part about training is actually probably to build past that point, right? Of how can I get enough ease at speed where I then have this, like, elasticity of pace where I can slow down, right? Because, it's if you're struggling at 12-minute pace, 11:30 pace, 13-minute pace, well, 20-minute pace is definitely walking. And to be clear, like, the issue is that you're not having that, you know, launching effect, to oversimplify it and, speak about it in a vernacular way. But, like, when you're running, like, you only have one foot on the ground at a time, and then there's this little pause where you're in the air. When you're walking, you have one foot on the ground at all times, right? So that is, like, a limiting factor there. With a bicycle, you could say, well, below a certain speed, you're basically not really pedaling anymore, right? Or your pedaling is so separated from itself, right, that it's not continuous enough to really constitute cycling, right? But if you're getting winded after 10 pedal strokes and you have to take a break, you know, that can be challenging to then try to do a lot. Now, the reality is, if you work from where you're at, you know, you will be able to make improvements. That's how this stuff works. And so what this comes to then is this idea that the way we should be thinking about volume is not how much, right? But we should be thinking about hard and easy, right? Hard and easy. And we need to recognize, though, that these are things that we can control, but in the way that we think about them currently, we can't control, okay? The way we currently approach this in training is we say that, okay, you have hard days and you have easy days. And then it's like, oh, I did this day and this day was a hard day. Well, maybe that day felt really good and comfortable, in which case I would say that wasn't quote hard. It might have been very demanding. It might have created a significant sort of fatigue consequence, but not hard. And then, you know, if you go on the recovery day and you feel like a mess and at any tempo, you just basically, your legs are burning and you're like, oh my God, but you're thinking, I got to be out here because this is how I recover. That's not functional either, right? So in that situation, right, when we're supposed to be going, a lot of times we're supposed to be going easy, we're just a total mess, right? And then we say, oh, I had an easy day today or a recovery day. Well, did you feel effortless and floating and light on your feet? You know, did you feel like you're pedaling the bike like soft butter? Like, you know, whatever your, you know, metaphor or concept of ease is, like, if that's not what was happening, it wasn't an easy day, right? But there's this expectation that, oh, you took it easy, so you had this rest. And then that allows you to. But that's the thing, is that's not what's happening, because that's not the way we've engaged with it, because we're tackling the volume instead of looking at the volume as a fulcrum point, right? So what we, like, if you can run 20 miles at 5 minute pace easily, then you just have like a lot more room to work with. If you want to take an easy day, well, you can go out and run 10 minute pace, right? But if you're, you know, 20 miles is 9:30 pace, what are you going to do? Go out and run 17 minute pace? You know, right? Again, at a certain point, it's like, you know, this minimum necessary work rate, you know, becomes a problem for people. So we're not all, and then we're emulating these models based ultimately derived from the people who can run 20 miles at 5 minute pace, right? And then that's being, you know, reverse engineered onto everybody else. And, you know, that's not, and so then even if those people are, even if their reasoning is off, they are functionally using training as a leverage strategy to improve fitness, then the rest of us, the sort of writ large exercise fitness community of people, is just like tackling that the training is their obstacle, right? It's not facilitative, it's obstructive. So, you know, a lot of people simply say, fuck it, and just get in the cage match. You know, and I think some of these things are things that experiences that I thought, oh, maybe I'm the only person feeling like this. Well, people are so helpful by, you know, with their Strava stuff these days, it's pretty clear that, oh, I am not the only person experiencing this by any means, right? People constantly like, oh, felt like trash today, felt like trash. And it's not necessarily like a predictive cycle. It's like a lot of times they want to do something where they, you know, do something hard, and they said, I felt like trash. Well, what actually happened is on that day, you wanted to feel easy doing something that is at a proximal zone for you, so very close to your boundary of capacity. And you were too fatigued, so that then became hard. And because it was hard, you couldn't do it. So what we want to be thinking about is that this hard day, easy day thing is one of these concepts that is a scripted concept, and that we're just following it because we don't know how to question it, and because we have this ingrained tendency, not just in sports, but as people, we have this ingrained tendency to take the script and say, okay, but this is supposed to be what happens. This is what follows in the plot, right? Or this thing foreshadows this. This thing means this. Well, the reality, again, is it means whatever it occurs, right? So if somebody says, hey, great to see you, and then they punch you in the face, okay, right? Well, I thought they were really happy to see me. They said it was great to see me. Okay, they said that. They punched you in the face. So actually, now you have evidence that if somebody says, hey, it's great to see you, that actually means that they're going to punch you in the face. But because that's not the way we think about that, we can't accept that something could mean something other than our expectation, because we have been taught that our expectation is like, you know, a Newtonian law. And it's not. It's a social construct of expectation. And those can become very entrapping and very limiting. And we're just sort of, as people, it's difficult to recognize and reason and rationalize our way out of it. And a part of it is sort of this the abandonment of romanticism, right? There's this appeal to the sort of romanticized charm of following these cool, you know, training schedules and, you know, enacting the once a runner experience and, you know, all of these things that then lend legitimacy, right? The reality is that training effectively just it isn't like that, right? And so what's weird is people want it to be miserable, but they just want to be able to like actually survive it or be able to do it, but they want that aspect of it. And that's the fantasy. The fantasy is that training can be torturous and somehow wonderful, delightful, and enjoyable in some way, instead of looking at the reality of the situation and saying, okay, this is miserable and it's not actually enjoyable or glamorous to be miserable, you know, but everybody else in the sports space is, you know, posting and making it seem like it's this desirable thing to the point where people have FOMO in terms of their training and their, you know, and their running and cycling, skiing, whatever, their experiences around this stuff. They have FOMO about things that you absolutely, you know, should have like the opposite of FOMO. You should have celebration of missing out, right? You should have celebration, COMO, I don't know, whatever, right? But like these... And it just is, this is the irrationality of it. And it's entrapping. It's an entrapping structure of logic. So, you know, and training basically then, if we say, okay, the fulcrum gets at what we should know anyway, which is training is about improving fitness, right? So, that, for example, there's no such thing as 5K training versus 10K training. Right, you know, somebody once told me 30 miles a week is 10K training. Well, not only is that absurd in the sense that, okay, geez, 6 miles might feel really demanding if you only are running at an amount of 30 miles a week, but it's also, well, training for a 10K is things that improve your fitness such that you get more proficient at running a 10K. If that's 30 miles a week, that's great. If that's 150 miles a week, that's great, right? If you're improving, right, and it's consistent and you can sort of predict and manage how you feel. Now, this is one of these things, if you go back to some of the Arthur Lydiard stuff, you know, there's, you know, interviews with him that you can see on YouTube. And, you know, he says that, right, when they tried the interval training, the problem that they had is that they couldn't control how they would feel. Right, they would show up one day and they would be a disaster and they wouldn't be able to do anything. And in a lot of ways, we're basically still stuck in that space. We like to think that our training is more sophisticated to the point where we say, oh, somebody like this Lydiard person, that was from the 50s and the 60s, that's got to be like totally outdated. We've surpassed that. But the reality is we haven't. The reality is we're actually still stuck in that modality predominantly that he moved away from, which is just training in a dysregulated manner. And you could do a high volume, close quotes, lower intensity model, but in at least within what would be defined as that in the paradigm. But if we step out of that and say, well, let's really look at this from this functional interpretation, which is what I'm pushing for here, we're going to recognize like, oh, no, this is totally fucked. Right? This isn't working at all. You know, I write things down and say, well, I want to do these things. And I go out and I can't do them. And that's what he talked about. He said they couldn't get themselves to feel good on the day of the races, never mind get themselves to feel good on the days of the workouts. And that's the problem is that we're obfuscating the fact again, that like the experience people are having is one of incapacity. But instead, we're saying, I went out there, I couldn't do the workout, and that's really good because it means I'm training hard. No, it means you couldn't do anything that would actually be beneficial. But people take something that's basically a crappy experience, and then they claim that's a good experience. And then people are not only like, I accept that, but they're like, I want that same thing, right? And It to me it's nonsensical, and I say that as somebody who spent probably the better part of a decade plus in that space, where for again and again and again, I'd say, okay, I want to get in better shape. And if you've been listening to the pod for a while, a lot of this thinking is not a massive departure, but the big progression in thought that I've had in just the last week is I've had this recurring issue with shin splints, basically. And I never used to have a problem, right? But, in college, I used to weigh 143 pounds, right? Now I'm like 198 pounds, 202 pounds. And, my legs are significantly more muscular from, cycling and, just from not being 18 anymore and now being 36. Right, your body isn't, your body changes and, over time and, I eat how I feel like eating. I don't, count my calories and my macros per se, right? So I'm not killing myself to, be 167 pounds. So my thought process has been, oh, I've had this get these shin splints come on because, I'm trying to train and try to do a little more training or try to, add a little bit more to really try to see if I can get my fitness improving in the way I want. And then because I'm heavy, well, my shins just can't handle the load. And maybe when I start trying to run faster, is there something happening mechanically where those muscles just like can't are getting zoinked from pushing that mass? And it would come and it's come and gone, right? And it's always consistently when I would increase my training, right? So, and the epiphany I had around this is that the shin splints are because of the quadriceps. And if you look up stuff about shin splints, there's all this voodoo around, do this, do that, all this bullshit that doesn't do anything to help with shin splints. And if you really reason through it and you say, well, what's really going on? It's no logical, like stretching, right? This generic banality of, oh, just stretch it. Well, stretching doesn't do anything, but right, there's just this stuff that people just ubiquitously throw out there. And to me, anytime you see that generic, catch-all practices, then that's a sign that, okay, not only is this stuff not going to work here, but people don't really know what's going on. So, but the epiphany I had was a week ago. I went from feeling great, and I've been doing this routine where I've been sticking to the easy interval method for going back to June. So I totally bottomed out in terms of my energy level. And, I was sort of like at the point in May where I was like, I don't even know if I want to do this stuff anymore because I was just so tired from having horrible sleep, having a newborn. And as the sleep for my daughter started to improve, I started feeling a little bit better. So in June, I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to easy interval method, that kind of concept of approach. And, I went out on this level trail out and back. I'm going to keep it consistent, 9 mile session, warm up for 20, jog easy, really slow for 20 minutes, and then do 6 times 1,000, 800 meters easy in between. And, went along for a while. And then, I was like, really grinding the first rep, as I got into it and I got some training, general training fatigue, cumulative fatigue going, I really just noticed that grinding on the repetition, the first rep. And I was like, I don't like this. So, and then I was also, had done every once in a while, I had gone out and been like, it's hot and humid and miserable here, on a day, given day. And I'm like, I can't do these thousands right now. I'm basically going to get boiled up and shut down. So I would go, okay, I'm just going to do like 30 times 100 and just, run some comfortable, quick, but floating 100s and just do 3,000 meters of that. And I started doing that and I said, oh, I see, I think I'm feeling a little bit better on these thousands. So then I made this change where I said, I'm going to change my warm up period. Because in the warm up, I really wasn't feeling any more warmed up after the 2 miles of jogging than I was in the first 30 seconds. So, and I know, right? Okay, there's this relative effect, right? Of if you do something a little bit more intense and then you go a little easier, it feels significantly easier than if you go from right just at that. So I changed my warm up to 200 meter jog, 100 meter fast. Okay, but not sprints, comfortable, right? Only as fast as felt easy, right? Manageable, competent, right? Doing it with alacrity. And I did, you know, 9 of those, so go for 3,000 meters, then, you know, jog, walk, jog for 2 minutes, significantly better in the thousands. And what I noticed over the course of a week then is if I was giving it a little bit too much in the thousands, I would then come back on that third or fourth session. And because I was just trying to basically as much as possible do it every single day. And I think in the realities, it turned out to be between 4 to 6 times a week, depending, you know. And if I was putting too much pressure on it early in the week, I'd get tired, you know, because I wasn't actually staying within my competence. I was backsliding into these ingrained habits of, you know, training too hard, right? Which is really, really hard, no pun intended, to change. Because when you're so used to doing that, training, you think you're going easy, but you're still going too hard, right? So it's really difficult to change those habits when that's what you've done for years and years and years and years. And, you know, for me, for, you know, 20 plus years, pretty close to, you know, across different sports, basically just ingraining that habit and disposition. And so what would happen, though, in these 100 meter strides is at first, right, you know, if I'm having a good session, I'd feel very light, easy on the strides. And then strides, I just feel like a rock, you know, and then I'd go do the session and it would be a drag. And then I'd come back the next day and I'd start to feel it in my shins. And at first I've had this idea, like when this comes up, like, okay, I just need to keep going. And the muscles in the shins, right down the tibia, that those will adapt, right? If I can just keep going with the stuff, they'll adapt and this will go away. And to be honest, that's never really what happened. But again, that's the whole idea, right? Of like, we're not breaking out of our habits and routines because we're not looking at the stuff the right way. So, you know, I went in 3 days from having a great session to then the next day absolutely bagged trying to run 14 miles. Just felt like an absolute broken cement truck. And then the day after that, doing 3 miles and basically felt like I was sort of like running with broken bones in my legs because the shin pain was so significant. So then I was like, man, I might be totally screwed here again. And I'm going to have to take a bunch of time off. And so, but my quads had been messed up for 3 days. Like, you know, I could feel some soreness there. And so then the next day after that horrible 3 mile run, I said, I'm just not going to do anything today. Right. So I didn't run before work. I just went, came, did nothing. And the next day I'm like, okay, I'm going to go out, run, and then felt totally great again. And what had changed? The quads were back. And the quads are basically, in my interpretation, is in the way I'm thinking about this, is that, and I've got onto this idea because when you ride the gravel bike, I feel like you go on a 50-mile ride and you get this like fatigue effect that you don't get riding the road bike. And it's like, okay, the work rate you're doing isn't any different, right? The watts are the same. Why is this somehow more fatiguing? Well, it's the suspension effect. That the gravel bike doesn't have any suspension. You're going over these jarring roads, and that suspension effect is then happening with the legs and the body, and that's fatiguing your body in a way that riding on the road bike is when you don't have that suspension demand. And when you're running, right, you have this impact. And generally, the body is really good with running at sort of functioning in a suspension effective way. But when the quads are trashed, that suspension effect is gone. And so then I went out and I did 14 miles on quads that were fried. And then I went out the next day. And so now I have nothing in the quads. They're not contributing. And they're not, so that force is still happening and it's got to, you know, so it's going to go in somewhere else, right? And for me, that's blowing up the shins. And in this vein, I was like, you know, this is the hard day, easy day problem. This is the fulcrum effect, is I'm still defaulting to, and without realizing it, because a lot of times I just want to go out and exercise and not have to think about it. And what I've realized is that's not an option, because if you don't think about it, you're just going to do it the way you've always done it. And when you're trying to shift away from that, that's a huge problem. So in order to, what you need to do is you need to form a concept in your head. Visualization, I guess. I don't really like visualization, because to me, visualization always meant picture yourself running as hard as you can, and then you'll be able to run as hard as possible. And that doesn't work, obviously. So I guess this would probably be the correct version of visualization, but I'm thinking of it as using the word concept, because visualization leaves a bad taste in my mouth after all these years. Form the concept in your head of like, well, what do I want this to feel like? Right? How does it feel? What does feeling easy and competent mean in this sense? Right? So that means that some days I might run 1000s in 405. Some days I might do them in 435. Right? And in old money terms, that's not acceptable. But what I'm saying is, okay, I know how it needs to feel. And I'm trying to literally, you know, as I'm warming up, the first thing I'm saying, okay, do I feel the right way when I'm doing these hundreds? Yeah, okay, that means I'm right. I can do this session today and not just do it, right? Because I could do it no matter what, force it out, but do it within the parameters that I'm setting for myself and saying, this is what it needs to be. And then, right, it's saying, okay, I'm going to work to create that thing that I've conceptualized, right? And like that 14-mile run I tried to do the other day, I should have just turned around after 50 feet and gone back to the car. I knew it was going to be bad, right? You just know, right? But it's like, oh, I want to do this run. You know, this is what I planned. So, okay, I guess I got to do it, right? You know, and that's the problem with exercising with other people. And I really, you know, I'm recognizing that I'm best served by training on my own exclusively. And I'm thinking that might be something I experiment with, going forward, is I, as much as I, you know, socially, it can be nice to have other people to work out with. I think that it actually might be the best possible thing to get away from that, because, you know, it might not even be that there's a fitness mismatch. It might just be that you made this social commitment to say, I'm going to go do this, but you get out of the car and you go 50 feet and you're like, nope. But because you're there and there's other people there, you can't just like turn around and go back in the car, because then it's going to be like, oh, I'm rude and I'm bailing on somebody. But I didn't, you know, want to be there. You know, I had a horrible time, and I would have, you know, given anything to be teleported away from that space, but I felt obligated to then do something that was, you know, not in my interest. And I, you know, paid the price for that. And, you know, this approach is not easy. And it's like something that, you know, you really have to work on and discuss and be metacognitive about. And this is where coaching is, what I think coaching really should be, would come into play. But because most coaches and athletes are just playing pin the tail on the donkey with this, right? Like, okay, you got 365 days a year. Sure, some of those days you're going to feel good. Some of those will be days where you want to feel good, right? But instead of asking yourself, did I feel good or bad, say, did I feel hard or easy? Every day you want to feel easy. Easy doesn't mean slow. Easy doesn't mean training that's not productive. Easy means every time I exercise, I want to feel comfortable, competent, and practicing, right? You want to feel like you're practicing well, okay? If you're trying to get better at an instrument, which I understand exercise is not playing an instrument, but, you know, I think the concept is perfectly appropriate. Like, if you just pick up a guitar or you sit down at the piano and you just start smashing the keys randomly, no growth is going to occur. But when you're out training with this, you know, hard days, easy days thing, where the language doesn't line up with the experience, you can't get any better that way. And how do you manage that, right? Well, be liberal with your recovery on your intervals. Be willing to get back in the car and go home. And if you know, training with other people makes that hard, then like, don't train with other people, at least not and at least not for a little while until you can figure that stuff out, how it needs to be on your own. And like, if you do this over time, you will find that you start making progress. And what you're going to notice is that exercise is going to feel more enjoyable and you're going to be better at it and you're going to improve more. And I think the issue with this stuff, and, you know, I think with, and this comes back to the sort of core reality of what we're trying to explore in Black Cats Run, is that people don't do this stuff and then don't engage it this way because of the romanticization of it, that I'm taking that from them, right? You know, it's you know, like, ruin, it's like you tell somebody, but like if somebody thought The Notebook was a true story, you know, and then you came, well, actually, that's fiction. They don't want to hear that, right? You know, or even if they know that that's fiction, they want to think, well, it's fiction, but it's what really happens or whatever. And it's the fantasy, right? And people don't want their fantasy broken. And there's an aspect of escapism from this stuff. And I guess if that's really what people want, then you get into this question of entitled experience. And, you know, if you're not harming other people, then you're entitled to that experience. But what I'm suggesting is that, at least for me, and I think for a lot of other people too, if they could get to this point and figure out how to approach it in this way, the reality is that simply going about it differently is to the point where they can feel good every day. Like, for me, that's why I do this stuff, right? Is I want to feel strong and competent. You know, I want to be able to go out and run 10-mile training run at 6:40 pace and feel great and have it feel easy and comfortable, right? I don't care who sees me, right? I don't need to be seen or recognized, because people seeing me or recognizing me, people accepting me as a part of the in-group and whatever, it doesn't give me that feeling of competence, right? That feeling of powerful. I would rather have powerful, strong runs where I feel that energized feeling and have nobody and never be seen by anybody. You know, I could care less about that. And I think that's a distinction for a lot of people, is if you're doing it for these like external reasons, or where you're just sort of like, well, why are you exercising? And the reality is, the real answer is, well, everybody else is doing this, so I'm just chasing it, and I haven't stopped to think about how this relates to what I'm actually experiencing. You know, and that's a different can of beans that, you know, maybe for a whole nother episode. But, you know, I know we haven't uploaded in a while, and a lot of these kinds of ideas too are, you know, embedded in the book, in terms of, you know, trying to think differently about intensity, but try to do it in a way that's not just, you know, selling snake oil or saying random stuff to, you know, swim upstream for the sake of swimming upstream, but, you know, saying that, you know, is there genuinely a better way to go about it? So if you've been feeling like you've been stagnating, struggling with injury, whatever, you know, my recommendation would be to evaluate, do you feel good? Do you feel like you're running well? How many times a month? Maybe none sometimes. And I would suggest it needs to be all of the time. And that can be really hard to do, because it's abandoning this dogmatic concept of input to output in training. But the reality is, training hard just makes you worse. Thanks for listening to today's episode. We do have our book, The Blood and the Rain, forthcoming. Hopefully that's back on track for sometime this fall. If you're interested in getting a copy directly from me, you can email us blackcatsrunpod@gmail.com, or you can find us on our Instagram page at blackcatsrun. I'll catch you next time.